a correspondence making it quite plain that his retirement was arranged. I found, from what he told me, that Mr. Vholes had copies of these papers, and had been in consultation with him throughout. Beyond ascertaining this, and having been the bearer of Ada's letter, and being, as I was going to be, Richard's companion back to London, I had done no good by coming down. Admitting this to myself with a reluctant heart, I said I would return to the hotel and wait until he joined me there. So he threw a cloak over his shoulders and saw me to the gate, and Charlie and I went back along the beach. There was a concourse of people in one spot, surrounding some naval officers who were landing from a boat and pressing about them with unusual interest. I said to Charlie this would be one of the great Indiaman's boats now, and we stopped to look. The gentlemen came slowly up from the waterside, speaking good-humouredly to each other and to the people around, and glancing about them as if they were glad to be in England again. "Charlie, Charlie," said I, "come away." And I hurried on so swiftly that my little maid was surprised. It was not until we were shut up in our cabin room and I had had time to take breath that I began to think why I had made such haste. In one of the sunburnt faces I had recognised Mr. Alan Woodcourt, and I had been afraid of his recognising me. I had been unwilling that he should see my altered looks. I had been taken by surprise, and my courage had quite failed me. But I knew this would not do, and now said to myself, "My dear, there is no reason, there is and there can be no reason at all, why it should be worse for you now than it ever has been. What you were last month, you are today. You are no worse, you are no better. This is not your resolution. Call it up, Esther, call it up." I was in a great tremble with running, and at first was quite unable to calm myself. But I got better, and I was very glad to know it. The party came to the hotel. I heard them speaking on the staircase. I was sure it was the same gentleman, because I knew their voices again. I mean, I knew Mr. Woodcourt's. It would still have been a great relief to me to have gone away without making myself known, but I was determined not to do so. "No, my dear, no. No, no, no." I untied my bonnet and put my veil half up, I think I mean half down, but it matters very little, and wrote on one of my cards that I happened to be there with Mr. Richard Carstone, and I sent it to Mr. Woodcourt. He came immediately. I told him I was rejoiced to be by chance among the first to welcome him home to England, and I saw that he was very sorry for me. "You have been in shipwreck and peril since you left us, Mr. Woodcourt," said I, "but we can hardly call that a misfortune which enabled you to be so useful and so brave. We read of it with the truest interest. It first came to my knowledge through your old patient, poor Miss Flight, when I was recovering from my severe illness."
"Ah, little Miss Flight," he said, "she lives the same life yet?"
"Just the same." I was so comfortable with myself now as not to mind the veil and to be able to put it aside. "Her gratitude to you, Mr. Woodcourt, is delightful. She is a most affectionate creature, as I have reason to say."
You have found her so?" he returned. I am glad of that."
He was so very sorry for me that he could scarcely speak. "I assure you," said I, "that I was deeply touched by her sympathy and pleasure at the time I have referred to."
"I was grieved to hear that you have been very ill."
"I was very ill."
"But you have quite recovered?"
"I have quite recovered my health and my cheerfulness," said I. "You know how good my guardian is, and what a happy life we lead, and I have everything to be thankful for, and nothing in the world to desire." I felt as if he had greater commiseration for me than I had ever had for myself. It inspired me with new fortitude and new calmness to find that it was I who was under the necessity of reassuring him. I spoke to him of his voyage out and home, and of his future plans, and of his probable return to India. He said that was very doubtful. He had not found himself more favoured by fortune there than here. He had gone out a poor ship's surgeon, and had come home nothing better. While we were talking, and when I was glad to believe that I had alleviated, if I may use such a term, the shock he had had in seeing me, Richard came in. He had heard downstairs who was with me, and they met with cordial pleasure. I saw that after their first greetings were over, and when they spoke of Richard's career, Mr. Woodcourt had a perception that all was not going well with him. He frequently glanced at his face, as if there were something in it that gave him pain, and more than once he looked towards me as though he sought to ascertain whether I knew what the truth was. Yet Richard was in one of his sanguine states, and in good spirits, and was thoroughly pleased to see Mr. Woodcourt again, whom he had always liked. Richard proposed that we all should go to London together, but Mr. Woodcourt, having to remain by his ship a little longer, could not join us. He dined with us, however, at an early hour, and became so much more like what he used to be that I was still more at peace to think I had been able to soften his regrets. Yet his mind was not relieved of Richard. When the coach was almost ready, and Richard ran down to look after his luggage, he spoke to me about him. I was not sure that I had a right to lay his whole story open, but I referred in a few words to his estrangement from Mr. Jarndyce, and to his being entangled in the ill-fated Chancery suit. Mr. Woodcourt listened with interest, and expressed his regret. "I saw you observe him rather closely," said I. "Do you think him so changed?"
"He is changed," he returned, shaking his head.
I felt the blood rush into my face for the first time, but it was only an instantaneous emotion. I turned my head aside, and it was gone.
"It is not," said Mr. Woodcourt, "his being so much younger or older or thinner or fatter or paler or ruddier, as there being upon his face such a singular expression. I never saw so remarkable a look in a young person. One cannot say that it is all anxiety or all weariness, yet it is both, and like ungrown despair."
"You do not think he is ill?" said I.
"No, he looked robust in body."
"That he cannot be at peace in mind we have too much reason to know," I proceeded. "Mr. Woodcourt, you are going to London?"
"Tomorrow or the next day."
"There is nothing Richard wants so much as a friend. He always liked you. Pray see him when you get there. Pray help him sometimes with your companionship if you can. You do not know of what service it might be. You cannot think how Ada and Mr. Jarndyce and even I, how we should all thank you, Mr. Woodcourt."
"Miss Summerson," he said, more moved than he had been from the first, "before heaven, I will be a true friend to him. I will accept him as a trust, and it shall be a sacred one."
"God bless you," said I, with my eyes filling fast. But I thought they might, when it was not for myself. "Ada loves him. We all love him. But Ada loves him as we cannot. I will tell her what you say. Thank you, and God bless you, in her name."
Richard came back as we finished exchanging these hurried words, and gave me his arm to take me to the coach.
"Woodcourt," he said, unconscious with what application, "pray let us meet in London."
"Meet?" returned the other. "I have scarcely a friend there now but you. Where shall I find you?"
"Why, I must get a lodging of some sort," said Richard, pondering.
"Say at Vowles's, Simmons Inn."
"Good, without loss of time."
They shook hands heartily. When I was seated in the coach, and Richard was yet standing in the street, Mr. Woodcourt laid his friendly hand on Richard's shoulder and looked at me. I understood him and waved mine in thanks. And in his last look, as we drove away, I saw that he was very sorry for me. I was glad to see it. I felt for my own self as the dead may feel if they ever revisit these scenes. I was glad to be tenderly remembered, to be gently pitied, not to be quite forgotten.
Chapter 46. Stop Him. Darkness rests upon Tom All Alone's, dilating and dilating since the sun went down last night. It has gradually swelled until it fills every void in the place. For a time there were some dungeon lights burning, as the lamp of life burns in Tom All Alone's, heavily, heavily in the nauseous air, and winking, as that lamp too winks in Tom All Alone's, at many horrible things. But they are blotted out. The moon has eyed Tom with a dull, cold stare, as admitting some puny emulation of herself in his desert region unfit for life and blasted by volcanic fires. But she has passed on and is gone. The blackest nightmare in the infernal stables grazes on Tom All Alone's, and Tom is fast asleep. Much mighty speech-making there has been, both in and out of Parliament, concerning Tom, and much wrathful disputation how Tom shall be got right. Whether he shall be put into the main road by constables, or by beadles, or by bell-ringing, or by force of figures, or by correct principles of taste, or by high church, or by low church, or by no church. Whether he shall be set to splitting trusses of polemical straws with the crooked knife of his mind, or whether he shall be put to stone-breaking instead. In the midst of which dust and noise there is but one thing perfectly clear, to wit that Tom only may and can, or shall and will, be reclaimed according to somebody's theory, but nobody's practice. and in the hopeful meantime, Tom goes to perdition head foremost in his old determined spirit. But he has his revenge. Even the winds are his messengers, and they serve him in these hours of darkness. There is not a drop of Tom's corrupted blood, but propagates infection and contagion somewhere. It shall pollute this very night the choice stream in which chemists on analysis would find the genuine nobility of a Norman house, and his grace shall not be able to say nay to the infamous alliance. There is not an atom of Tom's slime, not a cubic inch of any pestilential gas in which he lives, not one obscenity or degradation about him, not an ignorance, not a wickedness, not a brutality of his committing, but shall work its retribution through every order of society up to the proudest of the proud, and to the highest of the high. Verily, what with tainting, plundering, and spoiling, Tom has his revenge. It is a moot point whether Tom all alone's be uglier by day or by night, but on the argument that the more that is seen of it the more shocking it must be, and that no part of it, left to the imagination, is at all likely to be made so bad as the reality, day carries it. The day begins to break now. And in truth it might be better for the national glory even that the sun should sometimes set upon the British dominions than that it should ever rise upon so vile a wonder as Tom. A brown, sunburnt gentleman, who appears in some inaptitude for sleep to be wandering abroad rather than counting the hours on a restless pillow, strolls hitherward at this quiet time. Attracted by curiosity, he often pauses and looks about him up and down the miserable byways. Nor is he merely curious, for in his bright dark eye there is compassionate interest. And as he looks here and there, he seems to understand such wretchedness, and to have studied it before. On the banks of the stagnant channel of mud which is the main street of Tom All Alone's, nothing is to be seen but the crazy houses, shut up and silent. No waking creature save himself appears except in one direction, where he sees the solitary figure of a woman sitting on a doorstep. He walks that way. Approaching, he observes that she has journeyed a long distance, and is footsore and travel-stained. She sits on the doorstep in the manner of one who is waiting, with her elbow on her knee and her head upon her hand. Beside her is a canvas bag, or bundle, she has carried. She is dozing, probably, for she gives no heed to his steps as he comes toward her. The broken footway is so narrow that when Alan Woodcourt comes to where the woman sits, he has to turn into the road to pass her. Looking down at her face, his eyes meet hers, and he stops.
"What is the matter?"
"Nothing, sir."
"Can't you make them hear? Do you want to be let in?"
"I'm waiting till they get up at another house, a lodging house, not here,"
the woman patiently returns.
"I'm waiting here because there will be sun here presently to warm me."
"I'm afraid you're tired. I am sorry to see you sitting in the street."
"Thank you, sir. It don't matter."
A habit in him of speaking to the poor and of avoiding patronage or condescension or childishness, which is the favourite device, many people deeming it quite a subtlety to talk to them like little spelling books, has put him on good terms with the woman easily.
"Let me look at your forehead," he said, bending down. "I am a doctor. Don't be afraid. I wouldn't hurt you for the world."
He knows that by touching her with his skilful and accustomed hand, he can soothe her yet more readily. She makes a slight objection, saying,
"It's nothing."
But he has scarcely laid his fingers on the wounded place when she lifts it up to the light.
"Aye, a bad bruise, and the skin sadly broken. This must be very sore."
"It do ache a little, sir,"
returns the woman with a started tear upon her cheek.
"Let me try to make it more comfortable. My handkerchief won't hurt you."
"Oh, dear no, sir, I'm sure of that."
He cleanses the injured place and dries it, and having carefully examined it and gently pressed it with the palm of his hand, takes a small case from his pocket, dresses it, and binds it up. While he is thus employed, he says, after laughing at his establishing a surgery in the street,
"And so your husband is a brickmaker?"
"How do you know that, sir?" asks the woman, astonished.
"Why, I suppose so from the colour of the clay upon your bag and on your dress. And I know brickmakers go about working at piecework in different places. And I am sorry to say I have known them cruel to their wives, too."
The woman hastily lifts up her eyes, as if she would deny that her injury is referable to such a cause, but feeling the hand upon her forehead, and seeing his busy and composed face, she quietly drops them again.
"Where is he now?"
asks the surgeon. "He got into trouble last night, sir, but he'll look for me at the lodging-house."
"He will get into worse trouble if he often misuses his large and heavy hand as he has misused it here. But you forgive him, brutal as he is, and I say no more of him, except that I wish he deserved it. You have no young child?"
The woman shakes her head. "One as a call's mine, sir, but it's Lizzie's."
"Your own is dead, I see. Poor little thing."
By this time he has finished and is putting up his case.
"I suppose you have some settled home. Is it far from here?"
he asks, good-humouredly making light of what he has done as she gets up and curtsies.
"It's a good 2 or 3 and 20 mile from here, sir. It's St. Albans. You know St. Albans, sir? I thought you gave a start, like, as if you did."
"Yes, I know something of it. And now I will ask you a question in return. Have you money for your lodging?"
"Yes, sir," she says. "Really and truly."
And she shows it. He tells her, in acknowledgment of her many subdued thanks, that she is very welcome, gives her good day, and walks away. Tom All Alone's is still asleep, and nothing is astir. Yes, something is. As he retraces his way to the point from which he descried the woman at a distance sitting on the step, he sees a ragged figure coming very cautiously along, crouching close to the soiled walls, which the wretchedest figure might as well avoid, and furtively thrusting a hand before it. It is the figure of a youth whose face is hollow and whose eyes have an emaciated glare. He is so intent on getting along unseen that even the apparition of a stranger in whole garments does not tempt him to look back. He shades his face with his ragged elbow as he passes on the other side of the way and goes shrinking and creeping on with his anxious hand before him and his shapeless clothes hanging in shreds. Clothes made for what purpose, or of what material, it would be impossible to say. They look, in colour and in substance, like a bundle of rank leaves of swampy growth that rotted long ago. Alan Woodcourt pauses to look after him, and note all this with a shadowy belief that he has seen the boy before. He cannot recall how or where, but there is some association in his mind with such a form. He imagines that he must have seen it in some hospital or refuge. Still, cannot make out why it comes with any special force on his remembrance. He is gradually emerging from Tom All Alone's in the morning light, thinking about it, when he hears running feet behind him, and looking round, sees the boy scouring towards him at great speed, followed by the woman.
"Stop him! Stop him!"
cries the woman, almost breathless.
"Stop him, sir!"
He darts across the road into the boy's path, but the boy is quicker than he, makes a curve, ducks, dives under his hands, comes up half a dozen yards beyond him, and scours away again. Still the woman follows, crying,
"Stop him, sir, pray, stop him!"
Alan, not knowing but that he has just robbed her of her money, follows in chase and runs so hard that he runs the boy down a dozen times, but each time he repeats the curve, the duck, the dive, and scours away again. To strike at him on any of these occasions would be to fell and disable him, but the pursuer cannot resolve to do that, and so the grimly ridiculous pursuit continues. At last, the fugitive, hard-pressed, takes to a narrow passage and a court which has no thoroughfare. Here, against a hoarding of decaying timber, he is brought to bay and tumbles down, lying gasping at his pursuer, who stands and gasps at him, until the woman comes up.
"Oh, you, Joe!" cries the woman. "What? I've found you at last!"
"Joe," repeats Alan, looking at him with attention. "Joe, stay. To be sure, I recollect this lad some time ago being brought before the coroner."
"Yes, we'll see you once afore at the inquich,"
whimpers Joe.
"What of that? Can't you never let such an unfortunate as me alone? Ain't I unfortunate enough for you yet? How unfortunate do you want me fur to be? I've been a-chivied and a-chivied, fust by one on you and next by another on you, till I'm warranted to skins and bones. The inquich weren't my fault. I done nothink. He was very good to me, he was. He was the only one I knowed to speak to as ever come across my crossing. It ain't very likely I should want him to be inquiched. I only wish I was myself. I don't know why I don't go like a hole in the water. I'm sure I don't."
He says it with such a pitiable air, and his grimy tears appear so real, and he lies in the corner up against the hoarding so like a growth of fungus or any unwholesome excrescence produced there in neglect and impurity, that Alan Woodcourt is softened towards him. He says to the woman, "Miserable creature, what has he done?" To which she only replies, shaking her head at the prostrate figure more amazedly than angrily.
"Oh, you Joe, you Joe! I've found you at last!"
"What has he done?" says Alan. "Has he robbed you?"
"No, sir, no robbed me. He did nothing but what was kind-hearted by me, and that's the wonder of it."
Alan looks from Joe to the woman, and from the woman to Joe, waiting for one of them to unravel the riddle.
"But he was along with me, sir," says the woman. "Oh, you Joe! He was along with me, sir, down at St. Albans, ill, and a young lady, Lord bless her for a good friend to me, took pity on him when I durstn't, and took him home."
Alan shrinks back from him with a sudden horror.
"Yes, sir, yes, took him home and made him comfortable, and like a thankless monster he ran away in the night and never has been seen or heard of since till I set eyes on him just now. And that young lady that was such a pretty dear caught his illness, lost her beautiful looks, and wouldn't hardly be known for the same young lady now if it wasn't for her angel temper and her pretty shape and her sweet voice. Do you know it? You ungrateful wretch, do you know that this is all along of you and of her goodness to you?"
demands the woman, beginning to rage at him as she recalls it, and breaking into passionate tears. The boy, in rough sort stunned by what he hears, falls to smearing his dirty forehead with his dirty palm, and to staring at the ground, and to shaking from head to foot, until the crazy hoarding against which he leans rattles. Alan restrains the woman merely by a quiet gesture, but effectually.
"Richard told me," he falters. "I mean, I have heard of this. Don't mind me for a moment. I will speak presently."
He turns away and stands for a while, looking out at the covered passage. When he comes back, he has recovered his composure, except that he contends against an avoidance of the boy, which is so very remarkable that it absorbs the woman's attention.
"You hear what she says? But get up! Get up!"
Joe, shaking and chattering, slowly rises and stands, after the manner of his tribe in a difficulty, sideways against the hoarding, resting one of his high shoulders against it, and covertly rubbing his right hand over his left, and his left foot over his right.
"You hear what she says? And I know it's true. Have you been here ever since?"
"Wish I may die if I seen Tom all alone till this blessed morning,"
replies Joe hoarsely.
"Why have you come here now?"
Joe looks all round the confined court, looks at his questioner no higher than the knees, and finally answers,
"I don't know how to do nothink, and I can't get nothink to do. I'm wery poor and ill, and I thought I'd come back here when there weren't nobody about and lay down and hide somewheres, as I knows on till arter dark, and then go and beg a trifle of Mr. Snagsby. He was allus willin' for to give me something, he was, though Mrs. Snagsby, she was allus a chivying on me, like everybody everywheres."
"Where have you come from?"
Joe looks all round the court again, looks at his questioner's knees again, and concludes by laying his profile against the hoarding in a sort of resignation.
"Did you hear me ask you where you have come from?"
"Tramp, then," says Joe.
"Now tell me," proceeds Alan, making a strong effort to overcome his repugnance, going very near to him and leaning over him with an expression of confidence, "tell me how it came about that you left that house when the good young lady had been so unfortunate as to pity you and take you home."
Joe suddenly comes out of his resignation, and excitedly declares, addressing the woman, that he never known about the young lady, that he never hearn about it, that he never went fur to hurt her, that he would sooner have hurt his own self, that he'd sooner have had his unfortunate head chopped off than ever gone anigh her, and that she was wery good to him, she was, conducting himself throughout as if in his poor fashion he really meant it, and winding up with some very miserable sobs. Alan Woodcourt sees that this is not a sham. He constrains himself to touch him.
"Come, Joe, tell me."
"No, I dustn't,"
says Joe, relapsing into the profile state.
"I dustn't, or I would."
"But I must know," returns the other. "All the same, come, Joe."
After two or three such adjurations, Joe lifts up his head again, looks round the court again, and says in a low voice,
"Well, I'll tell you something. I was took away. There."
"Took away? In the night?"
"Ah."
Very apprehensive of being overheard, Joe looks about him and even glances up some 10 feet, at the top of the hoarding, and through the cracks in it lest the object of his distrust should be looking over or hidden on the other side.
"Who took you away?"
"I dustn't name him," says Joe. "I dustn't do it, sir." But I want, in the young lady's name, to know. You may trust me. No one else shall hear.
Oh, but I don't know, replies Joe, shaking his head fearfully, as he don't hear.
Why, he is not in this place.
Oh, ain't he, though, says Joe. He's in all manner of places, all at onct.
Alan looks at him in perplexity, but discovers some real meaning and good faith at the bottom of this bewildering reply. He patiently awaits an explicit answer, and Joe, more baffled by his patience than by anything else, at last desperately whispers a name in his ear.
"Aye," says Alan. "Why, what had you been doing?"
"Nothing, sir. Never done nothing to get myself into no trouble, except in not moving on, and the inkwitch. But I'm a-moving on now. I'm a-moving on to the burying ground. That's the move as I'm up to."
"No, no, we will try to prevent that. But what did he do with you?"
"Put me in a hospital," replied Joe, whispering, "till I was discharged. Then give me a little money, 4 half-bulls, what you may call half-crowns, and says, 'Hook it. Nobody wants you here,' he says. 'You hook it. You go and tramp,' he says. 'You move on,' he says. 'Don't let me ever see you nowheres within 40 mile of London, or you'll repent it.' So I shall, if ever he do see me, and he'll see me if I'm above ground,"
concludes Joe, nervously repeating all his former precautions and investigations. Alan considers a little, then remarks, turning to the woman but keeping an encouraging eye on Joe, "He is not so ungrateful as you supposed. He had a reason for going away, though it was an insufficient one."
"Thank you, sir, thank ye," exclaims Joe. "There now, see how hard you was upon me, but only you tell the young lady what the gentleman says, and it's all right, for you was very good to me too, and I knows it."
"Now, Joe," says Alan, keeping his eye upon him, "come with me, and I will find you a better place than this to lie down and hide in. If I take one side of the way and you the other to avoid observation, you will not run away. I know very well, if you make me a promise."
"I won't. Not unless I was to see him a-coming, sir."
"Very well. I take your word. Half the town is getting up by this time, and the whole town will be broad awake in another hour. Come along. Good day again, my good woman."
"Good day again, sir, and I thank you kindly many times again."
She has been sitting on her bag, deeply attentive, and now rises and takes it up. Joe repeating,
"And you told a young lady as I never went for to hurt her, and what the gentleman says."
Nods and shambles and shivers and smears and blinks and half laughs and half cries a farewell to her, and takes his creeping way along after Alan Woodcourt, close to the houses on the opposite side of the street. In this order, the two come up out of Tom All Alone's into the broad rays of the sunlight and the purer air. Chapter 47. Joe's Will. As Alan Woodcourt and Joe proceed along the streets where the high church spires and the distances are so near and clear in the morning light that the city itself seems renewed by rest, Alan revolves in his mind how and where he shall bestow his companion. "It surely is a strange fact," he considers, "that in the heart of a civilized world, this creature in human form should be more difficult to dispose of than an unowned dog. But it is nonetheless a fact because of its strangeness, and the difficulty remains." At first he looks behind him often to assure himself that Joe is still really following. But look where he will, he still beholds him close to the opposite houses, making his way with his wary hand from brick to brick and from door to door, and often, as he creeps along, glancing over at him watchfully. Soon satisfied that the last thing in his thoughts is to give him the slip, Alan goes on, considering with less divided attention what he shall do. A breakfast stall at a street corner suggests the first thing to be done. He stops there, looks round, and beckons Joe. Joe crosses and comes halting and shuffling up, slowly scooping the knuckles of his right hand round and round in the hollowed palm of his left, kneading dirt with natural pestle and mortar. What is a dainty repast to Joe is then set before him, and he begins to gulp the coffee and to gnaw the bread and butter, looking anxiously about him in all directions as he eats and drinks, like a scared animal. But he is so sick and miserable that even hunger has abandoned him.
"I thought I was almost a-starving, sir," says Joe, soon putting down his food. "But I don't know nothink, not even that. I don't care for eating wittles, nor yet for drinking on 'em."
And Joe stands shivering and looking at the breakfast wonderingly. Alan Woodcourt lays his hand upon his pulse and on his chest.
Draw breath, Joe.
It draws, says Joe, as heavy as a cart.
He might add,
and rattles like it,
but he only mutters,
I'm a-moving on, sir.
Alan looks about for an apothecary's shop. There is none at hand, but a tavern does as well, or better. He obtains a little measure of wine and gives the lad a portion of it very carefully. He begins to revive almost as soon as it passes his lips.
We may repeat the dose, Joe, observes Alan after watching him with his attentive face. So, now we will take 5 minutes' rest and then go on again.
Leaving the boy sitting on the bench of the breakfast stall, with his back against an iron railing, Alan Woodcourt paces up and down in the early sunshine, casting an occasional look towards him without appearing to watch him. It requires no discernment to perceive that he is warmed and refreshed. If a face so shaded can brighten, his face brightens somewhat, and by little and little he eats the slice of bread he had so hopelessly laid down. Observant of these signs of improvement, Alan engages him in conversation and elicits, to his no small wonder, the adventure of the lady in the veil, with all its consequences. Joe slowly munches as he slowly tells it. When he has finished his story and his bread, they go on again. Intending to refer his difficulty in finding a temporary place of refuge for the boy to his old patient, zealous little Miss Flight, Alan leads the way to the court where he and Joe first foregathered. But all is changed at the Rag and Bottle shop. Miss Flight no longer lodges there. It is shut up. And a hard-featured female, much obscured by dust, whose age is a problem, but who is indeed no other than the interesting Judy, is tart and spare in her replies. These sufficing, however, to inform the visitor that Miss Flight and her birds are domiciled with a Mrs. Blinder in Bell Yard. He repairs to that neighbouring place, where Miss Flight, who rises early that she may be punctual at the divan of justice held by her excellent friend the Chancellor, comes running downstairs with tears of welcome and with open arms.
"My dear physician!" cries Miss Flight. "My meritorious, distinguished, honourable officer!"
She uses some odd expressions, but is as cordial and full of heart as sanity itself can be, more so than it often is. Alan, very patient with her, waits until she has no more raptures to express, then points out Joe, trembling in a doorway, and tells her how he comes there.
"Where can I lodge him hereabouts for the present? Now you have a fund of knowledge and good sense and can advise me."
Miss Flight, mighty proud of the compliment, sets herself to consider. But it is long before a bright thought occurs to her. Mrs. Blinder is entirely let, and she herself occupies poor Gridley's room.
"Gridley,"
explains Miss Flight, clapping her hands after a 20th repetition of this remark.
"Gridley, to be sure, of course, my dear physician, General George will help us out."
It is hopeless to ask for any information about General George, and would be, though Miss Flight had not already run upstairs to put on her pinched bonnet and her poor little shawl, and to arm herself with her reticule of documents. But as she informs her physician in her disjointed manner on coming down in full array, that General George, whom she often calls upon, knows her dear Fitz Jarndyce and takes a great interest in all connected with her, Alan is induced to think that they may be in the right way. So he tells Joe, for his encouragement, that this walking about will soon be over now, and they repair to the General's. Fortunately, it is not far. From the exterior of George's shooting gallery and the long entry and the bare perspective beyond it, Alan Woodcourt augurs well. He also descries promise in the figure of Mr. George himself, striding towards them in his morning exercise, with his pipe in his mouth, no stock on, and his muscular arms, developed by broadsword and dumbbell, weightily asserting themselves through his light shirt sleeves.
"Your servant, sir,"
says Mr. George, with a military salute. Good-humouredly smiling all over his broad forehead, up into his crisp hair, he then defers to Miss Flight as, with great stateliness and at some length, she performs the courtly ceremony of presentation. He winds up with another,
"Your servant, sir,"
and another salute.
"Excuse me, sir, a sailor, I believe,"
says Mr. George. "I am proud to find I have the air of one," returns Alan, "but I am only a sea-going doctor."
"Indeed, sir, I should have thought you was a regular blue jacket myself."
Alan hopes Mr. George will forgive his intrusion the more readily on that account, and particularly that he will not lay aside his pipe, which, in his politeness, he has testified some intention of doing.
"You're very good, sir,"
returns the trooper,
"as I know by experience that it's not disagreeable to Miss Flight, and since it's equally agreeable to yourself.
and finishes the sentence by putting it between his lips again. Alan proceeds to tell him all he knows about Joe, unto which the trooper listens with a grave face.
"And that's the lad, sir, is it?"
he inquires, looking along the entry to where Joe stands staring up at the great letters on the whitewashed front, which have no meaning in his eyes. "That's he," says Alan. "And, Mr. George, I am in this difficulty about him. I am unwilling to place him in a hospital, even if I could procure him immediate admission, because I foresee that he would not stay there many hours if he could be so much as got there. The same objection applies to a workhouse, supposing I had the patience to be evaded and shirked, and handed about from post to pillar in trying to get him into one, which is a system that I don't take kindly to."
"No man does, sir,"
returns Mr. George. "I am convinced that he would not remain in either place, because he is possessed by an extraordinary terror of this person who ordered him to keep out of the way. In his ignorance, he believes this person to be everywhere, and cognizant of everything."
"May I ask your pardon, sir?" says Mr. George. "But you have not mentioned that party's name. Is it a secret, sir?"
"The boy makes it one, but his name is Bucket."
"Bucket the detective, sir?"
"The same man."
"The man is known to me, sir,"
returns the trooper, after blowing out a cloud of smoke and squaring his chest.
"And the boy is so far correct that he undoubtedly is a rum customer."
Mr. George smokes with a profound meaning after this, and surveys Miss Flight in silence. "Now I wish Mr. Jarndyce and Miss Summerson at least to know that this Joe, who tells so strange a story, has reappeared, and to have it in their power to speak with him if they should desire to do so. Therefore I want to get him for the present moment into any poor lodging kept by decent people where he would be admitted. Decent people and Joe, Mr. George," says Alan, following the direction of the trooper's eyes along the entry, "have not been much acquainted, as you see. Hence the difficulty. Do you happen to know anyone in this neighbourhood who would receive him for a while on my paying for him beforehand?" As he puts the question, he becomes aware of a dirty-faced little man standing at the trooper's elbow and looking up, with an oddly twisted figure and countenance, into the trooper's face. After a few more puffs at his pipe, the trooper looks down askant at the little man, and the little man winks up at the trooper.
"Well, sir,"
says Mr. George,
"I can assure you that I would willingly be knocked on the head at any time if it would be at all agreeable to Miss Summerson, and consequently I esteem it a privilege to do that young lady any service, however small. We are naturally in the vagabond way here, sir, both myself and Phil. You see what the place is. You're welcome to a quiet corner of it for the boy, if the same would meet your views. No charge made, except for rations. We're not in a flourishing state of circumstances here, sir, and we're liable to be tumbled out neck and crop at a moment's notice. However, sir, such as the place is, and so long as it lasts, here it is at your service."
With a comprehensive wave of his pipe, Mr. George places the whole building at his visitor's disposal.
"I take it for granted, sir," he adds, "you being one of the medical staff, that there is no present infection about this unfortunate subject."
Alan is quite sure of it.
"Because, sir,"
says Mr. George, shaking his head sorrowfully,
"we have had enough of that."
His tone is no less sorrowfully echoed by his new acquaintance. "Still, I am bound to tell you," observes Alan, after repeating his former assurance, "that the boy is deplorably low and reduced, and that he may be, I do not say that he is, too far gone to recover."
"Do you consider him in present danger, sir?"
inquires the trooper. "Yes, I fear so."
"Then, sir,"
returns the trooper, in a decisive manner,
"it appears to me, being naturally in the vagabond way myself, that the sooner he comes out of the street, the better. You, Phil, bring him in."
Mr. Squad tacks out, all on one side, to execute the word of command, and the trooper, having smoked his pipe, lays it by. Joe is brought in. He is not one of Mrs. Pardigal's Tokahoopo Indians. He is not one of Mrs. Jellaby's lambs, being wholly unconnected with Borrioboola-Gar. He is not softened by distance and unfamiliarity. He is not a genuine foreign-grown savage. He is the ordinary, home-made article. Dirty, ugly, disagreeable to all the senses, in body a common creature of the common streets, only in soul a heathen. Homely filth begrimes him. Homely parasites devour him. Homely sores are in him. Homely rags are on him. Native ignorance, the growth of English soil and climate, sinks his immortal nature lower than the beasts that perish. Stand forth, Joe, in uncompromising colours. From the sole of thy foot
to the crown of thy head there is nothing interesting about thee. He shuffles slowly into Mr. George's gallery and stands huddled together in a bundle, looking all about the floor. He seems to know that they have an inclination to shrink from him, partly for what he is and partly for what he has caused. He, too, shrinks from them. He is not of the same order of things, not of the same place in creation. He is of no order and no place, neither of the beasts nor of humanity. "Look here, Joe," says Alan. "This is Mr. George." Joe searches the floor for some time longer, then looks up for a moment, and then down again. "He is a kind friend to you, for he is going to give you lodging room here." Joe makes a scoop with one hand, which is supposed to be a bow. After a little more consideration and some backing and changing of the foot on which he rests, he mutters that he is
weary thankful.
"You are quite safe here. All you have to do at present is to be obedient and to get strong. And mind you tell us the truth here, whatever you do, Joe."
"Wish I might die if I don't, sir,"
says Joe, reverting to his favourite declaration.
"I never done nothink yet, but what you knows on, to get myself into no trouble. I never was in no other trouble at all, sir, except not knowing nothink and starvation."
"I believe it. Now attend to Mr. George. I see he's going to speak to you."
"My intention merely was, sir,"
observes Mr. George, amazingly broad and upright,
"to point out to him where he can lie down and get a thorough good dose of sleep. Now, look here."
As the trooper speaks, he conducts them to the other end of the gallery and opens one of the little cabins.
"There you are, you see. Here is a mattress, and here you may rest, on good behaviour, as long as Mr. I ask your pardon, sir."
He refers apologetically to the card Alan has given him.
"Mr. Woodcourt, pleases. Don't you be alarmed if you hear shots. They'll be aimed at the target and not you. Now there's another thing I would recommend, sir,"
says the trooper, turning to his visitor.
"Phil, come here."
Phil bears down upon them according to his usual tactics.
"Here is a man, sir, who was found, when a baby, in the gutter. Consequently, it is to be expected that he takes a natural interest in this poor creature. You do, don't you, Phil?"
"Certainly and surely I do, Governor," is Phil's reply.
"Now I was thinking, sir,"
says Mr. George, in a martial sort of confidence, as if he were giving his opinion in a council of war at a drumhead,
"that if this man was to take him to a bath and was to lay out a few shillings in getting him one or two coarse articles—"
"Mr. George, my considerate friend," returns Alan, taking out his purse, "it is the very favour I would have asked." Phil Squad and Joe are sent out immediately on this work of improvement. Miss Flight, quite enraptured by her success, makes the best of her way to court, having great fears that otherwise her friend the Chancellor may be uneasy about her, or may give the judgment she has so long expected in her absence, and observing,
"Which you know, my dear physician and general, after so many years, would be too absurdly unfortunate."
Alan takes the opportunity of going out to procure some restorative medicines, and obtaining them near at hand, soon returns to find the trooper walking up and down the gallery, and to fall into step and walk with him.
"I'll take it, sir," says Mr. George, "that you know Miss Summerson pretty well?"
"Yes, it appears."
"Not related to her, sir?"
"No, it appears."
"Excuse the apparent curiosity," says Mr. George. "It seemed to me probable that you might take more than a common interest in this poor creature, because Miss Summerson had taken that unfortunate interest in him. 'Tis my case, sir, I assure you."
"And mine, Mr. George." The trooper looks sideways at Alan's sunburnt cheek and bright dark eye, rapidly measures his height and build, and seems to approve of him.
"Since you've been out, sir, I've been thinking that I unquestionably know the rooms in Lincoln's Inn Fields where Bucket took the lad according to his account. Though he is not acquainted with the name, I can help you to it. It's Tulkinghorn. That's what it is."
Alan looks at him inquiringly, repeating the name.
"Tulkinghorn. That's the name, sir. I know the man, and know him to have been in communication with Bucket before respecting a deceased person who had given him offence. I know the man, sir, to my sorrow."
Alan naturally asks what kind of man he is.
"What kind of man? Do you mean to look at?"
"I think I know that much of him. I mean to deal with, generally, what kind of man?"
"Why, then I'll tell you, sir,"
returns the trooper, stopping short and folding his arms on his square chest so angrily that his face fires and flushes all over.
"He is a confoundedly bad kind of man. He is a slow, torturing kind of man.
"'He is no more like flesh and blood than a rusty old carbine is. "'He is a kind of man, by George, "'that has caused me more restlessness and more uneasiness "'and more dissatisfaction with myself than all other men put together. "'That's the kind of man Mr. Tulkinghorn is.'
"'I'm sorry,' says Alan, "'to have touched so sore a place.'
"'Sore?'
"'The trooper plants his legs wider apart, "'wets the palm of his broad right hand "'and lays it on the imaginary moustache.
"'It's no fault of yours, sir.' But you shall judge. He's got a power over me. He's the man I spoke of just now as being able to tumble me out of this place neck and crop. He keeps me on a constant seesaw. He won't hold off, and he won't come on. If I have a payment to make him, or time to ask him for, or anything to go to him about, he don't see me, don't hear me. Passes me on to Melchizedek's in Clifford's Inn. Melchizedek's in Clifford's Inn passes me back again to him. "'He keeps me prowling and dangling about him "'as if I was made of the same stone as himself. "'Why, it's been half my life now, "'pretty well loitering and dodging about his door. "'What does he care? "'Nothing. "'Just as much as the rusty old carbine I've compared him to. "'He chafes and goads me till... "'Bah! Nonsense. "'I'm forgetting myself, Mr. Woodcourt.'
"'The trooper resumes his march.'
"'All I say is, he is an old man, but I'm glad I shall never have the chance of setting spurs to my horse and riding at him in a fair field. If I had that chance, in one of the humours he drives me into, he'd go down, sir.'
Mr. George has been so excited that he finds it necessary to wipe his forehead on his shirt sleeve. Even while he whistles his impetuosity away with the national anthem, some involuntary shakings of his head and heavings of his chest still linger behind— not to mention an occasional hasty adjustment, with both hands, of his open shirt collar, as if it were scarcely open enough to prevent his being troubled by a choking sensation. In short, Alan Woodcourt has not much doubt about the going down of Mr. Tulkinghorn on the field referred to. Joe and his conductor presently return, and Joe is assisted to his mattress by the careful Phil, to whom, after due administration of medicine by his own hands, Alan confides all needful means and instructions. The morning is by this time getting on apace. He repairs to his lodgings to dress and breakfast, and then, without seeking rest, goes away to Mr. Jarndyce to communicate his discovery. With him, Mr. Jarndyce returns alone, confidentially telling him that there are reasons for keeping this matter very quiet indeed, and showing a serious interest in it. To Mr. Jarndyce, Joe repeats in substance what he said in the morning, without any material variation. Only that cart of his is heavier to draw, and draws with a hollower sound.
"'Let me lay here quiet and not be chivvied no more,' falters Joe, "'and be so kind to any person as is a passing nigh where I used for to sleep, as just to say to Mr. Sangsby that Joe, what he known once, is a-moving on right forwards with his duty, and I'll be very thankful.' I'll be more thankful than I am already if it was any ways possible for an unfortunate to be it.
He makes so many of these references to the law stationer in the course of a day or two that Alan, after conferring with Mr. Jarndyce, good-naturedly resolves to call in Cook's Court, the rather as the cart seems to be breaking down. To Cook's Court, therefore, he repairs. Mr. Snagsby is behind his counter in his grey coat and sleeves, inspecting an indenture of several skins which has just come in from the engrosser's, an immense desert of law hand and parchment, with here and there a resting place of a few large letters to break the awful monotony and save the traveller from despair. Mr. Snagsby puts up at one of these inky wells and greets the stranger with his cough of general preparation for business. "You don't remember me, Mr. Snagsby?" The stationer's heart begins to thump heavily, for his old apprehensions have never abated. It is as much as he can do to answer,
"No, sir, I can't say I do. I should have considered, not to put too fine a point upon it, that I never saw you before, sir."
"Twice before," says Alan Woodcourt. "Once at a poor bedside, and once—"
"It's come at last,"
thinks the afflicted stationer, as recollection breaks upon him.
"It's got to a head now, and he's going to burst."
But he has sufficient presence of mind to conduct his visitor into the little counting-house and to shut the door.
"Are you a married man, sir?"
"No, I am not."
"Would you make the attempt, though single,"
says Mr. Snagsby, in a melancholy whisper,
"to speak as low as you can? For my little woman is a-listening somewheres, or I'll forfeit the business and £500.
In deep dejection, Mr. Snagsby sits down on his stool with his back against his desk, protesting,
I never had a secret of my own, sir. I can't charge my memory with ever having once attempted to deceive my little woman on my own account since she named the day. I wouldn't have done it, sir, not to put too fine a point upon it. I couldn't have done it. I durstn't have done it. Whereas, and nevertheless, I find myself wrapped round with secrecy and mystery, till my life is a burden to me.
His visitor professes his regret to hear it, and asks him, does he remember Joe? Mr. Snagsby answers with a suppressed groan, oh, don't he?
You couldn't name an individual human being, except myself, that my little woman is more set and determined against than Joe, says Mr. Snagsby.
Alan asks why.
Why?
Repeats Mr. Snagsby, in his desperation clutching at the clump of hair at the back of his bald head.
How should I know why? But you are a single person, sir, and may you long be spared to ask a married person such a question.
With this beneficent wish, Mr. Snagsby coughs a cough of dismal resignation, and submits himself to hear what the visitor has to communicate.
There again, says Mr.
Snagsby, who between the earnestness of his feelings and the suppressed tones of his voice is discoloured in the face.
At it again, in a new direction. A certain person charges me in the solemnest way not to talk of Joe to anyone, even my little woman. Then comes another certain person, in the person of yourself, and charges me in an equally solemn way not to mention Joe to that other certain person above all other persons. Why, this is a private asylum. Why, not to put too fine a point upon it, this is bedlam, sir, says Mr. Snagsby.
But it is better than he expected, after all, being no explosion of the mine below him, or deepening of the pit into which he has fallen. And being tender-hearted, and affected by the account he hears of Joe's condition, he readily engages to look round as early in the evening as he can manage it, quietly. He looks round very quietly when the evening comes, but it may turn out that Mrs. Snagsby is as quiet a manager as he. Joe is very glad to see his old friend, and says, when they are left alone, that he takes it uncommon kind as Mr. Snagsby should come so far out of his way on accounts of such as him. Mr. Snagsby, touched by the spectacle before him, immediately lays upon the table half a crown, that magic balsam of his for all kinds of wounds.
"And how do you find yourself, my poor lad?"
inquires the stationer, with his cough of sympathy.
"I'm in luck, Mr. Snagsby, I am," returns Joe, "and don't want for nothink. I'm more comfortabler nor you can't think, Mr. Snagsby. I'm very sorry that I done it, but I didn't go for to do it, sir."
The stationer softly lays down another half-crown, and asks him what it is that he is sorry for having done.
"Mr. Snagsby," says Joe, "I went and give a illness to the lady as was, and yet as warn't, the t'other lady, and none of 'em never says nothink to me for having done it on accounts of their being so good, and my having been so unfortunate. The lady come herself and see me yesterday, and she says, 'Ah, Joe,' she says, 'we thought we'd lost you, Joe,' she says, and she sits down a-smiling so quiet, and don't pass a word nor yet a look upon me for having done it, she don't, and I turns agin the wall, I does, Mr. Snagsby, and Mr. Jarndyce, I see him a-forced to turn away his own self, and Mr. Woodcock, he come for to give me something for to ease me, what he's always a-doing on day and night, and when he come a-bending over me and a-speaking up so bold, I see his tears a-falling, Mr. Snagsby."
The softened stationer deposits another half-crown on the table. Nothing less than a repetition of that infallible remedy will relieve his feelings.
"What I was a-thinking on, Mr. Snagsby,"
proceeds Joe,
"was as you was able to write wery large, p'raps?"
"Yes, Joe, please God," returns the stationer.
"Uncommon precious large, p'raps?"
says Joe with eagerness.
"Yes, my poor boy."
Joe laughs with pleasure.
"What I was a-thinking on then, Mr. Snagsby, was that when I was moved on as fur as ever I could go, and couldn't be moved no further, whether you might be so good p'raps as to write out wery large so that anyone could see it anywheres, as that I was wery truly hearty sorry that I'd done it, and that I never went fur to do it, and that though I didn't know nothing at all, I knowed as Mr. Woodcock once cried over it, and was allus grieved over it, and that I hoped as he'd be able to forgive me in his mind, if the writing could be made to say wery large, he might."
"I shall say it, Joe, very large."
Joe laughs again.
"Thank you, Mr. Snagsby. It's wery kind of you, sir, and it makes me more comfortabler nor I was afore."
The meek little stationer, with a broken and unfinished cough, slips down his fourth half-crown. He has never been so close to a case requiring so many, and is fain to depart.
and Joe and he upon this little earth shall meet no more. No more. For the cart so hard to draw is near its journey's end, and drags over stony ground. All round the clock it labours up the broken steps, shattered and worn. Not many times can the sun rise and behold it still upon its weary road. Phil Squad, with his smoky gunpowder visage, at once acts as nurse, and works as armourer at his little table in a corner, often looking round, and saying with a nod of his green baize cap, and an encouraging elevation of his one eyebrow, "Hold up, my boy, hold up!" There, too, is Mr. Jarndyce, many a time, and Alan Woodcourt, almost always, both thinking much how strangely fate has entangled this rough outcast in the web of very different lives. There, too, the trooper is a frequent visitor, filling the doorway with his athletic figure, and, from his superfluity of life and strength, seeming to shed down temporary vigour upon Joe, who never fails to speak more robustly in answer to his cheerful words. Joe is in a sleep, or in a stupor, today, and Alan Woodcourt, newly arrived, stands by him looking down upon his wasted form. After a while, he softly seats himself upon the bedside, with his face towards him, just as he sat in the law writer's room, and touches his chest and heart. The cart had very nearly given up, but labours on a little more. The trooper stands in the doorway still and silent. Phil has stopped in a low clinking noise, with his little hammer in his hand. Mr. Woodcourt looks round with that grave professional interest and attention on his face, and glancing significantly at the trooper, signs to Phil to carry his table out. When the little hammer is next used, there will be a speck of rust upon it. "Well, Joe, what's the matter? Don't be frightened."
"I thought," says Joe, who has started and is looking round, "I thought I was in Tom all alone's again. Ain't there nobody here but you, Mr. Woodcourt?"
"Nobody."
"And I ain't took back to Tom all alone's, am I, sir?"
"No."
Joe closes his eyes, muttering, "I'm very thankful."
After watching him closely a little while, Alan puts his mouth very near his ear and says to him in a low, distinct voice, "Joe, did you ever know a prayer?"
"Never know nothing, sir."
"Not so much as one short prayer?"
"No, sir, nothing at all. Mr. Chadbancy was a-praying once at Mr. Sangsby's, and I heard him, but he sounded as if he was a-speaking to hisself and not to me. He prayed a lot, but I couldn't make out nothing on it. Different times there was other gentlemen come down Tom all alone's a-praying, but they all mostly said as the t'other ones prayed wrong, and all mostly sounded to be a-talking to theirselves or a-passing blame on the t'others and not a-talking to us. We never knowed nothing. I never knowed what it was all about."
It takes him a long time to say this, and few but an experienced and attentive listener could hear, or hearing, understand him. After a short relapse into sleep or stupor, he makes, of a sudden, a strong effort to get out of bed. "Stay, Joe. What now?"
"It's time for me to go to that there burying ground, sir,"
he returns with a wild look. "Lie down and tell me. What burying ground, Joe?"
"Where they laid him as was very good to me. Very good to me indeed he was. It's time for me to go down to that there burying ground, sir, and ask to be put along with him. I wants to go there and be buried. He used for to say to me, 'I'm as poor as you today, Joe,' he says. I wants to tell him that I'm as poor as him now, and have come there to be laid along with him."
"By and by, Joe. By and by."
"Ah, perhaps they wouldn't do it if I was to go myself. But will you promise to have me took there, sir, and laid along with him?"
"I will indeed."
"Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. They'll have to get the key of the gate afore they can take me in, for it's always locked. And there's a step there, as I used for to clean with my broom. It's turned very dark, sir. Is there any light a-coming?"
"It is coming fast, Joe." Fast. The cart is shaken all to pieces, and the rugged road is very near its end. "Joe, my poor fellow."
"I hear you, sir, in the dark. But I'm a-groping. Let me catch hold of your hand."
"Joe, can you say what I say?"
"I'll say anything as you say, sir, for I knows it's good."
Our Father.
Our Father, is that very good, sir?
Which art in heaven.
Art in heaven. Is the light a-coming, sir?
It is close at hand. Hallowed by thy name.
Hallowed be thy...
The light is come upon the dark, benighted way. Dead. Dead, your majesty. Dead, my lords and gentlemen. Dead, right reverends and wrong reverends of every order. Dead, men and women, born with heavenly compassion in your hearts, and dying thus around us every day. Chapter 48. Closing In. The place in Lincolnshire has shut its many eyes again, and the house in town is awake. In Lincolnshire the deadlocks of the past doze in their picture frames, and the low wind murmurs through the long drawing-room as if they were breathing pretty regularly. In town the deadlocks of the present rattle in their fire-eyed carriages through the darkness of the night, and the deadlock Mercuries with ashes or hair-powder on their heads, symptomatic of their great humility, loll away the drowsy mornings in the little windows of the hall. The fashionable world, tremendous orb nearly 5 miles round, is in full swing, and the solar system works respectfully at its appointed distances. Where the throng is thickest, where the lights are brightest, where all the senses are ministered to with the greatest delicacy and refinement, Lady Dedlock is. From the shining heights she has scaled and taken, she is never absent. Though the belief she of old reposed in herself as one able to reserve whatsoever she would under her mantle of pride is beaten down, though she has no assurance that what she is to those around her she will remain another day, it is not in her nature when envious eyes are looking on to yield or to droop. They say of her that she has lately grown more handsome and more haughty. The debilitated cousin says of her that she's beauty enough, set up shop of women, but rather alarming kind. Reminding man fact, inconvenient woman, who will get out of bed and both establishment, Shakespeare. Mr. Tulkinghorn says nothing, looks nothing. Now, as heretofore, he is to be found in doorways of rooms, with his limp white cravat loosely twisted into its old-fashioned tie, receiving patronage from the peerage and making no sign. Of all men, he is still the last who might be supposed to have any influence upon my lady. Of all women, she is still the last who might be supposed to have any dread of him. One thing has been much on her mind since their late interview in his turret room at Chesney Wold. She is now decided and prepared to throw it off. It is morning in the great world, afternoon according to the little sun. The Mercuries, exhausted by looking out of window, are reposing in the hall and hang their heavy heads, the gorgeous creatures, like overblown sunflowers. Like them, too, they seem to run to a deal of seed in their tags and trimmings. Sir Leicester, in the library, has fallen asleep for the good of the country over the report of a parliamentary committee. My lady sits in the room in which she gave audience to the young man of the name of Guppy. Rosa is with her, and has been writing for her and reading to her. Rosa is now at work upon embroidery, or some such pretty thing, and as she bends her head over it, my lady watches her in silence. Not for the first time today. Rosa? The pretty village face looks brightly up. Then, seeing how serious my lady is, looks puzzled and surprised.
See to the door. Is it shut?
Yes. She goes to it and returns, and looks yet more surprised.
I am about to place confidence in you, child, for I know I may trust your attachment, if not your judgment. In what I am going to do, I will not disguise myself to you at least, but I confide in you. Say nothing to anyone of what passes between us.
The timid little beauty promises in all earnestness to be trustworthy.
Do you know,
Lady Dedlock asks her, signing to her to bring her chair nearer,
do you know, Rosa, that I am different to you from what I am to anyone?
Yes, my lady, much kinder. But then I often think I know you as you really are.
You often think you know me as I really am? Poor child. Poor child.
She says it with a kind of scorn, though not of Rosa, and sits brooding, looking dreamily at her.
Do you think, Rosa, you are any relief or comfort to me? Do you suppose your being young and natural and fond of me and grateful to me makes it any pleasure to me to have you near me? I don't know, my lady. I can scarcely hope so, but with all my heart I wish it was so. It is so, little one.
The pretty face is checked in its flush of pleasure by the dark expression on the handsome face before it. It looks timidly for an explanation.
And if I were to say today, go, leave me, I should say what would give me great pain and disquiet, child, and what would leave me very solitary. My lady, have I offended you? In nothing. Come here.
Rosa bends down on the footstool at my lady's feet. My lady, with that motherly touch of the famous ironmaster knight, lays her hand upon her dark hair and gently keeps it there.
I told you, Rosa, that I wished you to be happy, and that I would make you so if I could make anybody happy on this earth. I cannot. There are reasons now known to me, reasons in which you have no part, rendering it far better for you that you should not remain here. You must not remain here. I have determined that you shall not. I have written to the father of your lover, and he will be here today. All this I have done for your sake.
The weeping girl covers her hand with kisses, and says, what shall she do? What shall she do when they are separated? Her mistress kisses her on the cheek and makes no other answer.
Now be happy, child, under better circumstances. Be beloved and happy. Ah, my lady, I've sometimes thought, forgive my being so free, that you are not happy.
I.
Would you be more so when you have sent me away? Pray, pray, think again. Let me stay a little while.
I have said, my child, that what I do for your sake, not my own. It is done. What I am towards you, Rosa, is what I am now, not what I shall be a little while hence. Remember this and keep my confidence. Do so much for my sake, and thus all ends between us. She detaches herself from her simple-hearted companion and leaves the room. Late in the afternoon, when she next appears upon the staircase, she is in her haughtiest and coldest state, as indifferent as if all passion, feeling, and interest had been worn out in the earlier ages of the world, and had perished from its surface with its other departed monsters. Mercury has announced Mr. Rouncewell, which is the cause of her appearance. Mr. Rouncewell is not in the library, but she repairs to the library. Sir Leicester is there, and she wishes to speak to him first.
Sir Leicester, I am desirous, but you are engaged.
Oh, dear, no, not at all. Only Mr. Tulkinghorn. Always at hand, haunting every place. No relief or security from him for a moment.
I beg your pardon, Lady Dedlock. Will you allow me to retire?
With a look that plainly says, you know you have the power to remain if you will. She tells him it is not necessary and moves towards a chair. Mr. Tulkinghorn brings it a little forward for her with his clumsy bow and retires into a window opposite. Interposed between her and the fading light of day in the now quiet street, his shadow falls upon her, and he darkens all before her. Even so does he darken her life. It is a dull street under the best conditions, where the two long rows of houses stare at each other with that severity that half a dozen of its greatest mansions seem to have been slowly stared into stone, rather than originally built in that material. It is a street of such dismal grandeur, so determined not to condescend to liveliness, that the doors and windows hold a gloomy state of their own in black paint and dust, and the echoing mews behind have a dry and massive appearance, as if they were reserved to stable the stone charges of noble statues. Complicated garnish of ironwork entwines itself over the flights of steps in this awful street, and from these petrified bowers extinguishes for obsolete flambeaux gasp at the upstart gas. Here and there a weak little iron hoop, through which bold boys aspire to throw their friends' caps, its only present use, retains its place among the rusty foliage, sacred to the memory of departed oil. Nay, even oil itself, yet lingering at long intervals in a little absurd glass pot, with a knob in the bottom like an oyster, blinks and sulks at newer lights every night, like its high and dry master in the House of Lords. Therefore, there is not much that Lady Dedlock, seated in her chair, could wish to see through the window in which Mr. Tulkinghorn stands. And yet, she sends a look in that direction, as if it were her heart's desire to have that figure moved out of the way.
Sir Leicester begs his lady's pardon. She was about to say,
"Only that Mr. Rouncewell is here. He has called by my appointment. And that we had better make an end of the question of that girl. I am tired to death of the matter."
"What can I do to assist?" demands Sir Leicester, in some considerable doubt.
"Let us see him here and have done with it. Will you tell them to send him up?"
"Mr. Tulkinghorn, be so good as to ring." "Thank you. Request," says Sir Leicester to Mercury, not immediately remembering the business term, "request the iron gentleman to walk this way."
Mercury departs in search of the iron gentleman, finds and produces him,